This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Over the years, there have been two words that have summed up the most effective weapon in the fight against cancer: early detection. Now, researchers are trying hard to make early detection quicker, easier, and, well, earlier.
You're looking for the cancers that would have caused problems and are lethal in potential.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear about advances in the early detection of cancer and hear from a clinical researcher about the feasibility of finding warning signs for cancer in blood. We'll also focus on one of those tests that is generating a lot of controversy, the PSA test for prostate cancer. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. In many cases, if you are showing symptoms of cancer, it could be too late to mount an effective defense against the disease. So for years, doctors and researchers have been searching for ways to screen people for cancer before any signs of the disease begin to show. Joe Belinfi from the National Institutes of Health has more.
Some types of cancer can be found before they cause symptoms. Checking for cancer or for conditions that may lead to cancer in people with no symptoms is called screening.
The goal of screening is to detect cancers that would be easier to treat and particularly to change the outcome.
Dr. Barry Kramer at the NIH says it's not enough to just detect cancer early.
You're looking for the cancers that would have cause problems and are lethal in potential, hoping to pick them up at an earlier point in their development at a time when they can be treated and the death from the cancer averted.
Screening is a tool that's used across many illnesses, but Dr. Kramer adds that there are some particular challenges or differences when it comes to cancer screening.
In part because not all the cancers that we detect are lethal. And yet, under the microscope, they look similar enough to the lethal cancers that they have to be treated.
Therefore, in cancer screening, says Dr. Kramer, there is an element of overdiagnosis. There's also the concern of false positives.
So that happens quite commonly with a variety of screening tests. So the person without cancer actually has a positive test, and therefore they have to go through the fear, the false alarm, and the anxiety of going through workups in the fear that they may actually have cancer when they don't.
He also points out that screening tests can have some risks just from the tests themselves. But a key point Dr. Kramer emphasizes is that most screening tests are a closer call than previously thought.
For too long, we have relegated messages about screening to sound bites, simply convincing people that if you picked up a cancer when you didn't have any symptoms, that was necessarily a good thing. But we're learning more and more about the harms, and it's a closer call than we often like to think.
He recommends that people carefully weigh and discuss the benefits and risks of cancer screening.
I think that the public should be aware of the trade-offs. And if they're going to ask their doctor, they should come armed with a set of questions. And that is, what are the harms of the actual test? What are the benefits of having the test? How strong is the evidence? What is the magnitude of the benefits?
For more information about cancer screening and to get details about measuring the effectiveness of cancer screening tests and weighing the evidence from screening research studies, visit cancer.gov. Also, cancer screening and the science behind it is the topic of a recent special issue of the NCI Cancer Bulletin, which is also available at cancer.gov. This is Joe Belinfi.
So the bottom line, early detection, good. And that's been one of the primary objectives of many major cancer research initiatives. Much of that research has gone into finding so-called biomarkers circulating in blood that would indicate that cancer is forming in the body before any overt symptoms appear. But is that really feasible? There are just a few of these tests being used in clinical practice right now, and the current controversy over the PSA test for prostate cancer is further cause for concern over the reliability of these tests. In the January 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Daniela Conforti wrote a perspective article asking just that question. Dr. Conforti is a graduate of the postdoctoral diploma program in clinical chemistry at the University of Toronto and is currently a clinical biochemist at Life Labs, a community laboratory in Toronto. Dr. Conforti, many of these blood-based cancer biomarkers are already commonly used in clinical practice for risk surveillance and for monitoring therapy. But effective blood-based biomarkers for early diagnosis of cancer, those are lacking. Why are biomarkers for early detection of cancer so important?
Well, detecting any disease early, including cancer, is very important because it usually means more opportunities for different interventions and therapies with increased potential for improving patient survival and quality of life. For instance, there are many studies that have shown that early detection of breast cancer in women over 50 years of age with annual mammogram screening programs improves survival by about 20 to 25%. Also, patients with stage 1 ovarian cancer detected by transvaginal ultrasound have a 5-year survival rate of about 93% compared to only 30% for patients with stage 3 to stage 4 disease at diagnosis. Some other examples of cancer screening procedures and biomarkers that have considerably improved patient outcomes include Pap tests and now molecular tests for cervical cancer, colonoscopy, sigmoidoscopy, and fecal occult blood tests for colon cancer, blood human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG, for testicular cancer and for gestational trophoblastic disease, and also blood alpha-fetoprotein, or AFP, in those people who are at high risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma.
What criteria should a circulating biomarker for early detection of cancer fulfill?
As you mentioned in your introduction, Bob, only a few tumor biomarkers in clinical use are suitable for population screening and or early diagnosis. So a biomarker test for early detection of cancer should be sufficiently sensitive and specific. And here I refer to both diagnostic and analytical sensitivity and specificity. Also, it should be relatively inexpensive and safe to be applied to mass populations. It should also be relatively non-invasive and provide sufficient lead time. A lead time is the time interval from screen-detected cancer to clinical diagnosis in the absence of such screening. So in other words, it is the time between asymptomatic disease and metastasis. The lead time for early cancer detection using a blood biomarker depends on the growth trajectory of a cancer. An aggressive tumor will have a significantly shorter lead time than a slow-progressing tumor. Usually, improved lead time means more effective interventions, which leads to improved disease outcomes and improved survival. Another important requirement for bringing a blood-based biomarker into routine clinical use is developing of high-throughput, easy-to-use laboratory tests to reproducibly and accurately measure such biomarker. In addition to these requirements, clinical benefits provided by a tumor marker should clearly outweigh any potential harms. Two examples are overdiagnosis and overtreatment of indolent cancers that will not lead to symptoms or cause death. Another potential harm is a lead time bias, and this refers to early diagnosis of a cancer that does not lead to improved survival. One good example of a blood biomarker for early cancer detection whose benefits and harms are still hotly debated is prostate-specific antigen, or PSA. There's still not sufficient evidence to definitely answer the question of whether early detection of prostate cancer always improves quality of life and or patient survival.
Well, given this long list of requirements, how feasible is it to identify circulating biomarkers for early detection of cancer?
This is exactly the question that researchers Sharon Hori and Sanjeev Gambhir from Stanford University School of Medicine tried to tackle in their article published in Journal Science Translational Medicine at the end of 2011. The first objective of this study was to use mathematical modeling to quantify the time required for a growing malignant tumor to reach a sufficient size so that its blood biomarker levels can be detected by currently available blood tests. Ovarian cancer and CA125 biomarker were used to provide realistic baseline values for model simulations. Ovarian cancer was chosen because it remains relatively asymptomatic until advanced, and there is a significant opportunity for improvements in early detection. CA125 is considered a gold standard biomarker test for surveillance of women with epithelial ovarian cancer. It is not a screening test, but the main advantage is that it has been sufficiently studied with all the required model parameter values available from the literature. The second objective of the study by Hori and Gamber was to use the model to identify biomarker-related parameters that most greatly affect early cancer detection, and also quantify through simulations how much each baseline parameter value has to change to achieve early tumor detection. Tumor biomarker parameters that were tested in the model included rate of tumor biomarker shedding into the blood, tumor marker clearance, and the percentage of the tumor volume consisting of tumor cells. They also modeled in analytical sensitivity of clinically available biomarker tests. The authors chose a solid tumor with a diameter of 1 millimeter as the goal for early detection. Briefly, the model was designed to predict changes in the blood biomarker levels as a function of time and to relate them to the corresponding tumor burden, meaning tumor volume or tumor diameter. Two growth models were used in the study. The first model assumed exponentially growing tumor starting from its genesis. The second and more physiologically plausible model assumed both monoexponential growth as well as tumor decay. For each growth model, the authors tested two scenarios. In one scenario, a biomarker was 100% tumor-specific, and in the other, a biomarker was secreted by both tumor and normal cells.
Well, let's get to the last page of that. Can you summarize the main findings of that study by Hori and Gamber?
Well, the simulation-based analysis identified parameters that are useful in improving early cancer detection, and those are tumor marker shedding rates, biomarker specificity, and assay analytical sensitivity. Importantly, the study also identified parameters that do not improve early detection, and those are a fraction of biomarker reaching blood and the rate of its elimination from the circulation. In addition, the model quantified how far the parameters I have just mentioned must be perturbed to achieve early, in this case, submillimeter detection of cancer. So the estimated time until detection by current CA125 test was found to be about 10.6 to 12.6 years, at which point ovarian tumor is about 4 centimeters in diameter. And this agrees what is currently seen with transvaginal ultrasound procedures. According to the model, to detect a tumor with a diameter of 1 millimeter would require a biomarker that is almost 100% tumor-specific and has a shedding rate of about 10,000 times higher than that of any known protein tumor biomarker. Additionally, further improvements in the analytical sensitivity of current clinical assays by 10,000-fold would also be required. This way, the tumor would be detected in 5.6 years, which would provide us really with about 4 to 6 years of lead time advantage over current detection methods. Collectively, as you can see, these results indicate that it may not be feasible to use a single circulating biomarker for early detection of cancer.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Daniela Conforti continues with a look at the limitations of the study by Hori and Gamber. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1301. This is The Health Show.
I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Daniela Conforte, a graduate of the postdoctoral diploma program in clinical chemistry at the University of Toronto and a clinical biochemist at Life Labs in Toronto. We're talking about the feasibility of using circulating blood biomarkers for the early detection of cancer and honed in on a study by Drs. Sharon Hori and Sanjeev Gambhir from Stanford University School of Medicine. We heard about that study's conclusions, so I asked Dr. Conforte about the study's limitations.
Well, direct extrapolation of the model predictions to the clinical use is hard to validate for several reasons. One, tumor age cannot be accurately measured at clinical diagnosis. And two, there are no patient data correlating tumor size with blood biomarker levels, either before and after cancer diagnosis or for multiple time points throughout the natural course of disease progression. So this relationship between tumor size and blood biomarker levels that the model is based on is not really well understood. The model also may not be useful for cancers whose parameters are not available from the literature, those cancers that haven't been extensively researched, like ovarian cancer. This means a lot of assumptions have to be made in the modeling itself. The target of 1 millimeter for early detection that the author set may not be applicable or even necessary, in my opinion, for every type of cancer. The 1 millimeter target is more appropriate for early detection of an aggressive tumor with a short doubling time than for a slow-growing indolent tumor with a long doubling time. So a small improvement in early detection will affect the lead time of indolent tumors much more appreciably than that of aggressive tumors. I think that the goals of early cancer detection still need to be debated among researchers and clinicians. So when selecting criteria for a blood biomarker of interest, researchers have to consider the type of cancer and its aggressiveness.
How do you think the international research community can benefit from this and similar mathematical models in their efforts to identify those biomarkers for early detection of cancer?
I think models like this can be used to address the potential and limitations of tumor biomarkers in the early investigative stages. They can certainly help researchers to identify criteria for prioritizing biomarkers. Some may be more feasible to study than others. This can not only save time, but also help focus valuable resources that are so difficult to come by these days. Furthermore, mathematical models like this one can be used to perform simulations quickly across a wide range of biomarker-related parameters. Such simulations can also encompass the large inter- and intra-individual biomarker variation, in other words, biological variability that may exist for some types of cancer, and would make the model generalizable for any solid cancer that secretes a biomarker into circulation. With the current version of this model, only one or two tumor-related parameters can be manipulated at a time. Future versions should include simulations that are simultaneous of multiple parameters. My hope also is that models like this will be freely available to the researchers.
Well, finally, Doctor, where do you think researchers should aim their efforts in order to make blood-based biomarkers for early detection of cancer a reality?
I think the study by Hori and Gambert clearly shows that mathematical models can be important tools in the evaluation of relevant parameters of blood biomarkers for early detection of cancer. However, we have to understand that the models are as good as the assumptions they're based on and as good as the baseline clinical parameters obtained from biological data which are used in simulation studies. So what is needed in the future? For one, I think we need to expand our knowledge of the natural process of cancer initiation and progression. We need to do more research to better understand how tumor size relates to biomarker blood levels. For instance, what are in vivo biomarker shedding rates? What are the effects of tumor microenvironment on those shedding rates? What fraction of biomarker is reaching the blood? And how do these parameters change with time? These findings will clearly lead to development of multi-scale predictive mathematical models that can more accurately select characteristics of biomarkers that are necessary to improve early detection. Also, advancements in the areas such as nanotechnology will help improve much-needed analytical sensitivity of tumor biomarker assays. We usually talk about protein biomarkers. However, the research should also include non-protein blood biomarkers such as tumor-specific microRNAs, epigenetic biomarkers, mitochondrial DNA markers, post-translational modification, as well as anti-tumor immune response markers. As this study showed, it may not be feasible to rely on single blood tests for early detection of cancer. A combination of a panel of circulating biomarkers and diagnostic imaging procedures is more likely to do the job.
Dr. Daniela Conforte is a graduate of the postdoctoral diploma program in clinical chemistry at the University of Toronto and is currently a clinical biochemist at Life Labs, a community laboratory in Toronto. Her perspective article, asking if early detection of cancer with circulating biomarkers is feasible, appears in the January 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Dr. Conforte mentioned the PSA test and the current controversy surrounding its effectiveness as a screening tool for cancer. Well, according to a recent major report from the Prostate, Lung, Colorectal, and Ovarian Cancer Screening Trial, a 17-year project of the National Cancer Institute, six annual screenings for prostate cancer led to more diagnoses of the disease, but no fewer prostate cancer deaths. The trial was designed to provide answers about the effectiveness of prostate cancer screening.
This particular report focused only on prostate cancer.
That's Dr. Christine Berg, the National Cancer Institute leader of the PLCO trial and senior author of the study.
And the straightforward analysis shows that at 7 years of follow-up, there was no decrease in death in the group that got actively screened compared to the group that got screened by their local physicians. However, there were 500 more cancers found. So we still saw 50 deaths in the actively screened group, 44 deaths in the less actively screened group, but we had 2,800 cancers in the actively screened group and 2,300 cancers in the less actively screened group. So detecting 500 more cancers did not prevent those other 50 deaths.
There were more than 76,000 men in the trial that was conducted at 10 centers around the United States. Of the men in the trial, roughly 38,000 were randomly assigned screening, including annual PSA tests. The others were randomly given usual care, but received no recommendations for or against annual prostate cancer screening. Dr. Berg explains that the difference between the numbers of deaths in the two groups was not statistically significant. Thus, there was no detectable mortality benefit for screening versus usual care.
And so when a man who's deciding whether to be screened or not needs to put this whole picture together. He needs to weigh his own individualized risk based on his age and family history and race. African American men tend to be at a somewhat higher risk. And he needs to look at his other health conditions. And he needs to talk with his physician or his urologist.
NCI does not have a recommendation about prostate cancer screening. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, whose recommendations are considered the gold standard for clinical preventive services, recently concluded that there is insufficient evidence to assess the balance of benefits and harms of prostate cancer screening in men younger than age 75, and recommended against prostate cancer screening in men age 75 and older. But Dr. Berg emphasizes that information from the PLCO trial will help.
This is leading towards our holy grail of individualized medicine. However, it comes with uncertainty in the process of us getting that information. It's a very complex mixture before we can say, all right, you gentlemen sitting in my office today, this is what your chances are, you know, in the future. And then it's still going to be measures of risks and benefits and individual risk tolerance.
Dr. Berg adds that the National Cancer Institute wants to understand why some prostate cancers are lethal even when found early by annual screening, and what approaches can be used to identify these more aggressive cancers when they can be effectively treated. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Till then, stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.